Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, a professor who says many private colleges may not make it through the economic downturn. But first, when it comes to credit cards, are you a deadbeat? That's what the industry calls good customers, people who don't accrue interest, who completely pay off their cards every month. And as Congress considers credit card reform today, curbing permanent interest rate hikes, late fees, and fine print disclosures, the industry is threatening to go after good customers. A final bill to rein in the credit card industry could be on President Obama's desk by the end of the week. Gail Marks Jarvis is personal finance columnist for the Chicago Tribune. And Gail, credit card companies say that those fees and charges that they get from bad customers subsidize the good customers. They say they'll have to start making more money off those good customers. So what might they do, and are they already doing it?
Well, the good customers are already hurting. They're calling me. They're very upset. So what might happen is this. This is what's being talked about. You might start to see more annual fees that you might have to pay on your credit cards. They've been getting away from those annual fees. You might see more of those. You might see higher interest on your credit cards. Basically, what you're going to see is just higher fees than you're used to as a stable credit card user.
We understand that there's even consideration of credit cards charging interest immediately upon a purchase. In other words, not wait to see if somebody won't pay off their bill and charge them interest then, but immediately charging interest at the point of purchase.
This would be horrible because there would basically be no reward for being a good customer. And your only outlet as someone who hated to pay interest would be to use your card and then go to your computer that day, that night, and pay it off completely, which is not the way we typically use credit cards. If that happens, for the good customer, life will definitely change.
Well, but wouldn't it change for the credit card companies, too? Will people leave if they have to do that?
You know, people probably will leave, but I need to talk to you about leaving credit card companies because people are leaving credit card companies now. The good customers are leaving now because they're angry at some of the things that are happening. For example, people who have been very good customers, if they don't use their credit card much, they're having some of their line of credit yanked for apparently no good reason, not based on what they're doing at least.
In other words, if you're, it's sort of punishment for not accruing more charges on your card.
That's correct. And the reason the credit card companies are doing that is, say, if you have a $10,000 line of credit or a $20,000 line of credit, they have to set up more reserves if they're allowing you $20,000 versus $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
So they're cutting good people who aren't using their $20,000, they're cutting them back down. On the face of it, you wouldn't think that would matter because that's not credit that you use anyway. But it does matter because the total line of credit that you're allowed affects your credit score because credit scores are calculated based on how much of your total credit you use. So $1,000 compared to $20,000 of credit is very different than $1,000 compared to $10,000.
So you're saying already credit card companies are cutting the credit lines of these really good customers that aren't accruing interest, which is affecting their credit scores even though they're very good customers.
That's happening, and some people don't even realize it yet. But when they do realize it, some people are getting angry, and they're saying, I'm so furious at this card company for doing this, I'm going to close out my card and use another one. Well, that's not a good idea, because if you close a credit card, then your line of credit also gets reduced, and so your credit score will be hampered because of that.
So it sounds, Gail Marks Jarvis, as if your advice would be to use your credit cards just a little bit to hold on to your credit line, but continue if you can to make sure you pay it off every month and not accrue the interest.
That's exactly what people should be doing now, and they should be using their credit cards only for purchases that they need, not for anything extra, and then they should pay it off every month. And my advice, don't even wait for the bill to come, because if you wait for the bill to come, you might miss it. Instead, just pay it off as quickly as you can.
Gail Marks Jarvis, personal finance columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Well, the crisis in the financial markets has set off a long brewing crisis in higher education, and many colleges may not make it through. That's according to a just published essay in the New York Review of Books by our next guest, Andrew Del Banco. He says that falling endowments are one problem. Schools were once very conservative, but many of the top schools followed the lead of Yale's chief investment officer, David Swensen, and moved into more risky and aggressive investment strategies, and also began relying on their invested endowments for more of their operating costs. Now those endowments, as we know, have plummeted, but most schools in the U.S. have less than 1% of the endowment of, say, Harvard, and they have additional problems. Professor Del Banco heads the American Studies program at Columbia University. His most recent book is Melville, His World and Work. But today we talk schools with him as he joins us from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York. Professor Del Banco, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And first of all, we're going to talk about the nuts and bolts. But just what are some of the anecdotes that tell you that schools are in trouble?
Well, out of old habit, I still read the student newspaper up at Harvard, and I read this week that their budget crisis is so serious they're cutting out hot breakfasts next year.
Pancakes. No more pancakes.
No more pancakes, no more nothing except cereal and cold milk, I guess, which is pretty startling since about a year ago there was a lot of talk in the press and even on Capitol Hill that universities were hoarding money and becoming too wealthy. Their endowments were up in the multiple billions of dollars. And questions were being asked about how they were spending their money. This year, university and college presidents are sending out emails to alumni saying, you know, we're battening down the hatches and we'll be okay, and please help us out because
right.
the money is flying out the window.
Well, and people might say, I could care less if Harvard students don't get pancakes. But of course, if Harvard is suffering at all, then everybody else is really in pain. So let's talk about that. What are the bigger problems that more colleges are facing than the Stanfords, Yales, and Harvards?
Well, the fundamental problem that we're all facing is that we have a financing system in this country on which we have depended, and it's worked pretty well for the last 50 years or so, that has enabled us to send more and more young people to institutions of higher education. It's a mix of middle-class commitment to pay for their children, institutional wealth to provide financial aid, and government support, both federal government and, in a way more importantly, state government support, as well as some private philanthropic support. This whole system has received a terrible shock in the last year.
Well, let's take those different parts of the system one at a time, starting with private. You say that all students are subsidized, even those who say they're paying the full sticker price?
That's right. We're often amazed by how much it costs to send a student to a private college. It can cost, when you add up the tuition and the room and board and the books and everything else, it can be pushing $50,000 these days. Most estimates will say that that $50,000 figure represents about two-thirds of the full cost of educating an individual student.
So in a way, you know, students, even students paying the full ticket, aren't really paying for their college education. As some,
That's
you
correct.
Know, that other third has to be covered by monies from the school. And even families that had been doing well had been depending, in many cases, on, let's say, home equity loans to subsidize paying for the college tuition, but their houses have plunged in value, so they don't have that anymore.
Right. Or if it's a two-income household, both parents are working and one has lost his or her job, then they have to go back to the financial aid office and say, you know, the award you gave my son or daughter last year was okay then, but it doesn't enable us to pay the bills this year.
And what about public institutions? How is the subsidy system failing them?
Well, public institutions have been primarily funded by state revenues, which, of course, are raised from taxes. And if you look at the trend over the last 25 or 30 years, the percentage of the overall budget of our state universities that is covered by public revenues has been going radically down, so that some institutions which might have been getting 40 or 50% of their budget covered from public funds are now having, you know, 20, 15, or even less than that covered. So we're in a very difficult situation. Our great public universities are not getting the support they need from the states.
Here's some of the statistics you give. The University of Virginia, 8% of the funding from the state compared to 30% a generation ago. University of Wisconsin, 19% of their funding comes from the state, down from 30% just 10 years ago. Well, let's go back to the private schools. We always hear about the competition to get into the big ones, but the bulk of the 1,500 private schools in this country, you say, don't have enough applicants.
That's right. Many private institutions have to go out and recruit students and have to hope that they get enough applicants to fill their class next year. And when you have very wealthy private institutions offering good scholarship support above you, as it were, in the pecking order, and you have public institutions where the tuition is lower below you in the pecking order, if you're in between, you're really squeezed, and there are, I think, real possibilities that some of these private institutions are not going to survive for another decade or two under these conditions.
You write about Clemson having mandatory unpaid five-day furloughs, Beloit laying off 10% of its staff because
right.
fewer students have registered. And what
right.
happens, Professor, when private school students can't get in the top schools or can't pay for private schools, and they move to public schools, and public school students move to community colleges?
Right.
What happens?
Well, that's a good way of putting it. These public institutions are seeing an increase in the applicant pool, whereas some of the private institutions are seeing a decline. So at the private school, you may have the problem of not having enough applicants, whereas at the public school, you have a problem of accommodating all those who want to get in.
Well, and that
your mandate, after all, is to educate all qualified students in your state or county or region if you're a community college.
But they can't afford them. So, for instance, you write about San Jose State University
right.
Forced by budget reductions to turn away thousands of qualified applicants.
Right. And the overall gist of all this is that it is getting harder for many Americans to get that college education. And we can see, even before this financial crisis, that our country has been slipping in its relative ability compared to the rest of the developed world to educate its citizens. That's really the fundamental problem here, which has been clarified and made vivid by this financial crisis.
A couple questions, though. As you've been saying, you know, this is essentially a private-public partnership pact that
right.
did much to democratize American higher education. As you describe it, it's been coming apart. But what about schools like Harvard offering free education to low-income students? Is that a plan?
Well, that's a great development, and we should all applaud the wealthy elite institutions for doing what they've been doing to open their doors to families who can't afford them. But frankly, I think most Americans would discover that the reality is not quite in sync with the rhetoric. Yes, these institutions have a need-blind admissions policy and a policy of providing full need aid, as they call it. But the real question is, where are they recruiting their applicants, and how significant a percentage of their student body comes from families with very little wealth? And the answer to that question is, it's a very small percentage. If you go to one of these institutions as a student, you're very likely to be spending your 4 years mostly with other young people from the same socioeconomic level as yourself.
That's Columbia University Professor Andrew Belbanco. When we come back, what about suggestions to save money and make education more available? Could we see some four-year institutions become three-year? And later today, a book for young adults and adult adults. It's being called The New Tom Sawyer. But we'll be back in 1 minute with Professor Delbanco here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Columbia University Professor Andrew Delbanco on the financial crisis in higher education. And Professor Delbanco, let's continue. You pointed the federal Pell Grants. In 1976, they covered 72% of a needy student's education. In 2003, only 38%. And you're also critical of state-based financial aid that's based on student worthiness as measured by things like tests. You say that affluent students do better on tests, and the result is that public aid is going more and more to kids who need it less. But you know the old argument. Many families getting that financial aid, even though middle class, say it's critical for them.
Well, look, I'm a parent, and I'm fortunate. I'm a professor at a private institution, so I have a fairly reasonable income. I feel very stressed by the tuition payments I have been paying for my children for many years. I understand that. But when the wealthiest institutions provide significant financial aid for children from families earning up to $200,000 a year, You have to stop and ask whether that's the best possible use of institutional resources. Because families in that income bracket do have options. As you move down the ladder and you get to less wealthy institutions, they have a choice. Are they going to direct their funds to the middle and upper middle class, or are they going to direct their funds to kids from families who really have no way to send their children to college without significant institutional support? And unfortunately, in the competitive environment where we find ourselves, financial aid is going to go increasingly toward families who need it relatively less. It's not that they don't need it, but they don't need it as much as families with fewer resources.
Well, in your view, Professor, it's a gloomy assessment of the world of higher education. What's your sense of what has to happen?
Well, I prefer the word realistic to the word gloomy, though there's reason to be concerned and maybe even alarmed. But on the other hand, you know, this is a very resilient country. What I'm really describing is the breakdown of a public-private partnership that worked quite well for 50 years, a period when we enormously expanded educational access for our citizenry. And I think that's been a period where education has been correlated with American world leadership. We are at a turning point. We need to rethink this system. We need to look at the reality of how much education costs. We need to look at the fact that the middle class has to pull in somewhat after this financial contraction that we've all experienced. So we're not going to be able to maintain this system on the same basis that we've had it for the last 50 years.
There's been a proposal of an overhaul of the financial aid system. There's also been proposals such as going from 4 to 3 years for college with less holidays.
Right. Well, I think one of the things we want to be wary of is that, of course, in an environment like this, there's going to be a lot of pressure for cost containment. And up to a point, that's perfectly reasonable. Educational institutions waste a lot of money. But at the same time, if the result of this financial contraction is that students feel they can't afford the quote-unquote luxury of getting a humanistic liberal education, of taking the time, and traditionally that has meant 4 years, to educate themselves in a rounded way, and instead they feel a great rush to get that marketable skill, get out there and get into the marketplace, I think that would be a great pity because it robs our young people of an important experience. And I think it's been one of the hallmarks of our society that we believe in a broad liberal education for everybody who's interested in getting one.
Well, there's also an argument not to saddle people with college and debt if, in fact, they can get a job in fields that don't require college degrees, an argument to be more supportive of vocational training. Or, you know, no college training at all. President Obama, speaking in the Sunday New York Times Magazine, said that his grandmother, who only had a high school education, could write better, more clearly than many of the students he taught in law school. And he's encouraging more of a focus on education before college. But do you worry that that is a slippery slope that leads to the way things used to be, only the elite go to college?
Well, that's what I would worry about. You know, on the one hand, it's perfectly true. Not everybody ought to have to go to college. And if our high schools did a better job, and that's, of course, where the problem starts, we would have educated high school graduates who would maybe be able to make good, responsible decisions about their own future lives. But on the other hand, I don't think we want to go in the direction that has been true in Europe for so many years, where young people are tracked from an early age. Somebody decides on the basis of a test, okay, you have what it takes to go to college, but you're going to be an auto mechanic. America has always believed in individual choice. It's believed in second chances. And it has a democratic commitment to the idea that all citizens have a great inner capacity. And I believe that's true. We've discovered in recent years through certain remarkable programs that prisoners in high-security prisons can benefit greatly from college education. And in fact, it's one of the most effective factors in reducing rates of recidivism. So education is not just for the elite. It's for everybody. And that's a fundamental American idea, which I think we want to be careful to protect in these perilous times.
You visited and spoke at a community college, and you say you came away with a sense of disjunction between rising hope and declining opportunity. Why? Tell us what you heard.
I went out to a community college and talked about Abraham Lincoln. And the students I met there were immigrants, recent immigrants. They were the children of blue-collar workers. They were kids from middle-class families who were in the community college because the family had lost its resources and couldn't afford to send them to a private school. Some of them spoke good English. Some of them were just learning English. But they all had a certain excitement about their education. They were engaged in what I was talking about. And yet it's getting harder for them to get that education. And as we were discussing earlier, many of their peers are, in effect, being kept out of the institution. And I think we really want to pay attention to that disjunction. We've got to deliver on what we promise in this country, or we will once again have an alienated generation that doesn't believe in the American dream.
Columbia University Professor Andrew Del Banco. His essay on the crisis in higher education appears in the current edition of the New York Review of Books. You can find it at our website, hereandnow.org. His most recent book is Melville, His World and Work. Love to have you back for that. But Professor Del Banco, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll learn about the life of Navy Commander Charles Springle, killed in Iraq by the American soldier he was trying to help. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, the effects of the economic downturn in the U.S. on coffee growers in Indonesia. After the news, Here and Now. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner said this week that despite some good news in the economy, unemployment will continue to rise. It's going to be bumpy and still feel fragile for a while, he said. Well, many people are already feeling fragile, among them a Hopkinton, Massachusetts software engineer named Larry Fowler. Larry's a consultant whose 24-year employment streak ended nearly a year ago. Frustrated that his job search hit one dead end after another, he decided to try something completely different.
Hi. My name is Larry Fowler, a top-notch embedded real-time software engineer with a B.S. in electrical engineering as well as a Ph.D. in computer science, looking for the next challenge. I am an innovative, out-of-the-box thinker with a history of success and the vision to solve your problems in the most efficient and cost-effective manner. Call me, Larry Fowler, at 508-
Fowler is advertising himself on the radio. For the next 3 days, classical music station WCRB-FM right here in the Boston area will be airing a slightly longer version of that ad on its airwaves. And Larry Fowler paid $1,500, we understand, Larry, for that privilege?
Yes.
Well, now, why? What had you gone through prior to trying an on-air ad?
I look for jobs on the internet for advertising. I call companies that I've worked for people I've worked with before, and I've had no success. I've been trying for a considerable time.
We understand you even tried a job training organization, and what did they do for you?
Well, they helped me write the resume, and I'm still working with them.
Mm-hmm.
The situation is that since I came to Massachusetts in 1985, I continually got calls, so I've never had to look for work, and my job interviewing skills and such are not too hot, I guess. So I contacted this company, and they helped me with my resume and how to search for jobs.
Was it their idea to try the ad on the radio station or yours?
This was my idea.
What did you think that would do for you?
I don't know. It's just something different, so I gotta take a chance. I mean, that's what I do. People hire me because I think differently than a lot of people and come up with new ideas, and this was just one of them.
Well, and you'd been very successful at that for 24 years. We should say you designed your own computerized house in the 1970s. You invented an automated test system for a remote-controlled insulin pump. You've been hired steadily. So it sounds as if you're obviously confronting the new economy, and your wife is as well, which I think gave this other urgency. Tell us about her job situation.
Well, she's was a general manager manufacturing solar panels. When the oil prices dropped at the end of last summer, why, they didn't have any more sales, and so they didn't need her anymore. And the company is basically on hold right now, and she was laid off.
So your wife is out of work as well, which I'm assuming gave this a little more urgency. But as you say, you're an innovative person. What was the response to your idea of selling yourself?
The first response, I discussed it with the agency that was coaching me, and they said, that's a pretty dumb idea. I don't think that'll ever work. And then after they thought about it for about 15 or 20 minutes, you know, and we talked about other things, they came back and says, you know, that's something different. It, you know, it's never been tried before. Maybe, who knows if that'll work.
Well, they were doubtful about you going on one radio station, and now look what you've done. being with us, you've gotten on several others because he's now being heard across the country. But I'm wondering, I mean, what if this takes off? Can you imagine, Larry, if suddenly all day, every day, we heard people's pitches for jobs on the air?
Well, I wouldn't be unique anymore. WCRB is discussing amongst themselves whether they might be interested in a program like that, depending on how successful I am. A lot of it depends on whether I find work, of course, you know, if I'm successful or not.
Well, then I know a great guy they could hire to help them do the software.
I'd like that, yes.
So word has gotten out about you. Are you getting any responses? I mean, the ads just started today, but of course there's been some buzz about it.
I got one response, and it was because of the article in the Boston Globe.
Mm-hmm.
It was just an email saying, are you interested in defense work?
So already you've gotten a response. That's Larry Fowler. He is a currently unemployed software engineer from Hopkinton, Massachusetts. He's available for work. And Larry, thank you for talking to us about your job search.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Back in half a minute, here and now. Welcome back. Let's get another reporter's notebook, this one from the streets of a busy shopping district of Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia. With some 240 million people, it's the fourth most populous country in the world. It's also comprised of more than 17,000 islands, so many no one really knows the exact number. Politically, Indonesia is now one of the world's biggest democracies, but for more than 30 years, it was basically a dictatorship under President Suharto. His record did include tremendous economic growth, but there was also a terrible human rights record, no freedom of speech. That changed when Suharto was pushed from power in the late 90s, largely because of the Asian economic crisis. But now, with a democratically elected government in place, there's another economic crisis. The BBC's Claire Boulderson is in Jakarta, reporting on the effects of the economic downturn on Southeast Asia. She joins us. And Claire, I know you used to live there, but this is your first trip back in nearly a decade. So what are your first impressions?
Robin, this country has changed unbelievably. I hate to say it, but I was first here nearly 20 years ago. I was the BBC correspondent. And then it was still very much a developing country. It was very poor. Jakarta was very poor. You could see people at the time sort of washing in the canals alongside the main roads, little sort of shanty towns all over the place. Not anymore. There has been an explosion of building. There's glitzy construction everywhere. There are huge shopping malls, absolutely unbelievable, with all the big names, Gucci, Versace, all of them are here.
Well, you talk about all of the growth that you saw. Now, we know that the country was hard hit during the 1997 Asian crash. So where is all the growth coming from now? What happened between 97 and now?
Indonesia has natural resources. It has just about everything you could want. It has copper, coal, natural gas, oil. It has things that grow on trees. It has palm oil. It has cocoa, coffee. And there's been a commodities boom in recent years, and this country has reaped the rewards. An awful lot of investment has come in, and a lot of people have made a lot of money.
Well, on the downside of all this growth, you talk about tens of thousands of unskilled migrant workers. Tell us more.
Yeah, that's a phenomenon that's happening all throughout Asia. People from the poorer countries go to the richer countries to be migrant workers, to work in construction and all sorts of things. But particularly the women go to be domestic servants in places like Hong Kong and Singapore. There's a growing demand for them, or at least there has been. But now those people in Singapore and Hong Kong and Japan and South Korea are losing their jobs. So we met a maid in East Java, a former maid. She had worked for someone in Hong Kong who lost his job. He was in construction. And he lost his job. The woman that she worked for lost her job at a bank. And this young girl, Achik, she had to come home. And so we talked to Achik back at her mother's house in Jemba, which is in East Java.
Banyak sekali teman saya yang kena imbas kayak gini.
A lot of my friends had the same bad luck as me. I think a lot of our employers invested in the stock market, including my boss. It seems that he lost a lot of money because of falling share prices. I overheard a lot of arguments in the house about money.
Achik had no choice. She had to return to Indonesia, where she'd once worked selling cosmetics in a local department store, a job that pays a fraction of her Hong Kong wage. And even those jobs aren't that easy to find.
It's going to be difficult for me to get a job here because there aren't many jobs around and I'm probably too old. There's a maximum age for sales staff, which is what I would be qualified for because I went to high school. But they want their staff to be younger than 25, and I'm already 30.
Will you also manage to hack your way out to rice fields to talk to farmers or coffee bean growers, for instance? And you found the recession touching them as well.
Yeah, now this is the really interesting thing. They have done very well because of exports, particularly of commodities in the past. But of course, the downturn now means exports are going down as well. Exports from here to the United States, for example, way down. That includes coffee. Think of all those people who are not drinking their lattes on your side of the world at the moment because they haven't got the money for them anymore. They haven't got the jobs. They're not picking up that coffee on the way into work. That has an effect here. And yeah, you're absolutely right. I saw it for myself out in a coffee plantation. I went to a little village in East Java called Sidomilio, and there was a coffee farmer there, Mr. Kursny, he was called, and he is very worried about what's going to happen to his coffee harvest this year. He's seeing the prices go down.
Last year was a good crop, and the price was good as well. But since then, the price has come down. We're not even into the main harvest yet, so I don't know what's going to happen.
You need more people in the United States and in Europe to drink more coffee, don't you?
I would like for them to drink more coffee. It would be good for us and good for them.
Yeah. We're getting a reporter's notebook from the BBC's Claire Balderson in Jakarta, Indonesia, hearing about coffee farmers, for instance. But Claire, just, you know, give us a, if you can, communicate to us over the radio, a sense of the smell and the taste and the feel of the land.
Well, that depends on where you are. I have to say, I love being out in the countryside, out in the fields, the rice fields of East Java, for example, where they're cut in terraces into the volcanic mountains that are all over this whole island of Java, which is the main island of Indonesia, where most of the population lives. And you kind of climb up through these hills, and it gets cooler and cooler as you get higher and higher. And then after the rice, you have your coffee and you have your cocoa and that kind of thing growing there. It's very rich, abundant, fertile land, partly because of that volcanic soil. Jakarta, of course, a rather different matter. Absolutely unbelievable traffic. Very polluted air, hot, of course. Huge contrast between these big, big urban areas and the beautiful countryside.
You write in your blog, the vibrant green rice fields. I don't know of any green like it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And you get that in Asia only, I think. It's a very, very bright, strong green, just as the new young rice plants are coming up. It's lovely.
On the other hand, as you were saying, Indonesia's, you know, really behind the curve when it comes to environmental protection. And there's a short video that we're going to have at our website, herenow.org, about the mud volcano. What is that?
Isn't it extraordinary, Robin? It's unbelievable. We were driving from the big town in East Java, Surabaya, and the young Indonesian producer who was working with us said, oh, do you want to see the mud volcano? And there was this huge lake of mud, and bubbling away in it are these fountains of mud that are coming out of the ground. And it's an extraordinary, very sad story. A company was exploring for natural gas in the area. Nobody knows what happened. Something went wrong. They hit something, which they now believe is some kind of weird geological formation that just happened to be there. And mud started spurting out. It swamped all these villages, and it won't stop.
And Claire, we just want to ask you before we let you go. We know you're also preparing reports on what Pakistan can possibly learn from Jakarta, on what Islamabad can possibly learn from Jakarta when it comes to tackling Islamic extremism. Can you just give us one overarching thought about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Indonesia is the world's most populous Muslim country. It has had problems with extremism. People might remember the Bali bombings in 2002. More than 200 people killed. There were bombings in Jakarta as well. But now it seems to have, I say seems to have, the problem largely under control. And for the most part, people here practice a very moderate form of Islam here in Indonesia. It is here in Indonesia. It is very moderate, and it's very mixed with Javanese culture. Islam came to this country in a very gentle way. It wasn't a conquering religion. And as a result, there's an awful lot of traditional Javanese culture mixed in with it. There's also the fact that democratic institutions are growing in strength here. It seems to be somewhat the other way around in Pakistan. And also, there's no war for people to fight on Indonesia's soil. A bit different from Pakistan, of course, where they've got Afghanistan right next door.
The BBC's Claire Balderson in Jakarta, Indonesia. She'll be broadcasting special programs all this week. For more, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. Claire, thanks so much for your reporter's notebook. Thanks for opening it for us.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Welcome back to Here and Now. In his stunning debut novel, which launched a publisher's bidding war, Rafe Larson gives us Tecumseh Sparrow Spivet, a 12-year-old Montana boy who attempts to bring order to his world by drawing maps, beautiful, highly calibrated creations which he keeps in his room in a system that can be rather perilous.
All of my notebooks were color-coded. The blue notebooks that neatly line the south wall of my room were reserved for maps of people doing things, as opposed to the green notebooks on the east wall, which contain zoological, geological, and topographical maps, or the red notebooks on the west wall, which was where I mapped out insect anatomy in case my mother, Dr. Claire Lineker Spivet, ever called upon my services. I had once tried lining maps on the north wall of my room, but in my excitement to organize, I briefly forgot that this was where the entrance to my room was located, and when Dr. Claire opened the door to announce that dinner was ready, the bookshelf fell on my head.
Dr. Claire, T.S.'s mother, is a distracted entomologist, his father a gruff Montana cowboy of few words. Are they normally so distant, or are they still in shock after T.S.'s beloved older brother, Layton, died in that shooting accident in the barn? We won't know for a while. We won't know till after T.S. hops a freight train to travel from his family ranch in Montana to Washington, D.C. to pick up a prestigious award he's received from scientists at the Smithsonian Institution, who obviously are unaware that this brilliant mapmaker is only 12. Rafe Larson's glorious book, Maps in the Margins and All, is called The Selected Works of T.S. Spivet, and Rafe joins us from public radio station KUT in Austin, Texas. Rafe, welcome.
Thank you very much.
We also won't know for a while where we are in time, because in the beginning, as you start reading this book, it feels all, you know, Tom Sawyer. He's mapping his sister shucking corn. But we find out it's set in contemporary America. So as you're writing it, what were you feeling about time?
I wanted to give it that kind of shimmer of timelessness that certain Westerns have. You know, you're not sure where they take place. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the American West in general has that kind of almost fairy tale like quality. Like it could have happened 1,000 years ago. It could have happened now. It could happen in the future.
Right. Who is T.S.? Is this a boy you knew growing up? Is this a character, someone you knew?
People have asked me a lot, you know, are you T.S.? And
that's kind of what I'm asking.
Yeah, I kind of sense that. And I guess I had, you know, elements of him in me. And I wanted in some ways to be like a T.S. character in that I would keep my own record of the world in my bedroom, but mm-hmm. I certainly wasn't that disciplined. I do share a kind of intense love of maps that T.S. and I both have. But, you know, I've always been interested in kids that possess a couple extraordinary abilities that kind of baffle the world of adults around them. And so whenever I meet a kid like that, I kind of pay extra close attention.
Well, as we should, and as I was reading the book, and we should say the maps are, well, here's one of two hands. You see a whole panel of hands. It's sort of on graph paper with charts and arrows and things, and it's T.S.'s illustration of Nervous Itsy Bitsy. It's his hands when he does the Itsy Bitsy spider, so he's graphed that out on graph paper. They're more artwork. And as I was reading, I was thinking, wow, who's this illustrator? It's you.
Yes, it is. And I actually wrote the book almost entirely without illustrations. I had a couple illustrations. I asked a couple of my friends to make some illustrations for it. And then I eventually realized, you know what, I have to do this myself because I'd probably drive the person who would illustrate this book crazy mm-hmm. with all my many, many requests.
It's in the margins, in these maps in the margins that contain the information from the drawings and then also notes. On page 11 here, it's in this margin that we first learn about the event that hangs over the whole family, which is that Layton was killed in an accident with a gun. T.S. was there. It was in the barn.
Yeah. You know, from my point of view, the relationship between the margins and the main text was one of the biggest challenges from the book. And I think the reader will realize quickly that they can't skip the marginalia. And in fact, that's where T.S. is almost the most comfortable, and he'll make these reveals or give these kind of emotional declarations that he wouldn't otherwise in the main text. They're often hidden in the last line of a sidebar.
Right. Well, and we also learn that part of what's happening to T.S. emotionally is has to do with Newton's law of physics. He quotes Newton quite a bit. He fiercely believes that every force demands an equal and relative force. So he is sort of waiting for the force to hit him after his brother's death. I mean, he's assuming something's going to happen to him.
Yeah, I mean, he has this tremendous guilt that why was it Leighton that met this end in the barn when Leighton is kind of the cowboy son that the father so revered, and T.S. is the odd bird on this ranch, although there's a lot of odd birds on this ranch. I think that T.S., over the course of the book, comes to a new understanding of Newton. I personally love that he's obsessed with Newton as the rest of the scientific world has moved on. You know, T.S. gets hung up on these things. He hasn't moved to computers. He hasn't moved to quantum mechanics. He's still rooted in the past in many ways, which is kind of lovable about him, I think.
We don't want to give away the end of the story, except to say what? Rafe Larson, what would you say about what T.S. learns at the end of his journey?
Things start to go awry, and T.S., who we have come to know as this intense observational empiricist who records kind of everything, I think when he's confronted with the world of adults who start to become obsessed with him in this way, it's the adults, it's not the kids, that make him kind of turn back into almost a kid again. But in doing so, I think he comes to terms with some big questions that he has been struggling with.
Mm. Well, Rafe Larson, as we said, it launched a bidding war, I think it was $900,000 publishing deal. Your debut novel. Are you surprised by this?
Oh, I had really modest expectations going into this. I mean, it's such a strange creature of a book in many ways. It's a weird shape. It has all these arrows popping out of it everywhere, and it's not necessarily like other books you would see. So I wanted it to be launched into the world in the way that it wanted to be. And then I wanted to be able to write another book. So all my expectations have been definitely met in that regard.
And did you want to sort of, you know, give a hurrah to, how to say it? Well, you've said this of yourself, to nerdy kids everywhere who might be, you know, using protractors and making maps on graph paper and keeping notebooks in their room while everybody else is on the computer.
Oh, yes. I'm a champion of nerds. I think they make the world go round. And I think, you know, most people are nerdish, whether they would admit it or not. We all have these little obsessive tendencies. And I think those are the tendencies that I'm most interested in.
That's Rafe Larson. His book is The Selected Works of T.S. Spivet. Rafe, thanks so much for speaking with us about it.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.